Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman with Juranov, and you're listening to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we try to provide information on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and at a time when maybe you need it, which is basically you don't have to sit and listen except when you're interested. So we have an interesting show today. I'm happy. This is the Pittsburgh day. We had David Reese and Thorpe Reed on earlier, and now here's David Cohen from the AmLaw 100, AmLaw 20, basically, if you want to create that list that small, from K&L Gates. And we're going to talk about sort of a top 10 list that's grown the top 20 on things to do to reduce the cost of e-discovery. I feel like an infomercial here, Dave, because if you act now, you can get another 10 in addition to the 10 we promised you. but let me introduce Dave. Dave's a partner at K&L Gates. He co-chairs the firm's e-discovery analysis and technology group, EDAT group. He's got over 25 years of commercial litigation experience. He's involved with a number of prominent organizations in e-discovery. He's on the advisory board of the Advanced E-Discovery Institute at Georgetown University Law Center, advisory board for the ABA Tech Show. And Dave and I have been involved with putting on two almost national conferences here in Pittsburgh called T-Bolt, which we've worked closely with. So, Dave, I'm glad to have you on the show today.
Oh, glad to participate, Carl.
Well, let's start off here with just sort of a general question before we save money for people. How did you get involved in electronic discovery?
Well, it was kind of you to mention my 25 years of litigation experience and remind me how old I'm getting. But early on, when I first came to K&L Gates in 83, as a young associate, I was put on some very big document cases, and back then it was the new associates who had to go through. I think it still is in some places, the new associates that have to go through and read lots and lots of documents. And that was really at the forefront of starting to use computers to help organize documents. Of course, we didn't have email back then or e-discovery, but we were starting to create computer databases. And from there, graduated into using microfilm and imaging to manage large document populations. And so while I continued on my commercial litigator path, my side specialty became automated litigation support, which then in the last decade or so morphed into e-discovery. And we set up our e-discovery practice group, I think, around 2005. We first founded our specialized practice group in e-discovery, and I've been chairing that group ever since.
Okay, well, let's start into our top 20 list here. Well, first of all, you talked about, you mentioned here prioritizing and phasing custodians. How does that help save money?
Well, you know, the biggest driver of how much e-discovery costs is the volume of information going in. And so there are a lot of ways at the outset that you can try and narrow. And the first thing we look at is what is the list of custodians that we're collecting information from. And what we have found is that many people just assume that anybody who has anything to do with a case needs to be included on the custodian list and all their information needs to be collected and processed. But what we have found is that you tend to have different levels of custodians. Some of them are going to be very key to a particular matter, and some of them are going to be relatively ancillary. While they may have some relevant information, it's probably information that's duplicated in the files of other people, and they're not the key folks. And very often, what you do have to do is you do have to preserve the information from everyone, because you got to make sure that nothing gets lost that is potentially relevant evidence. But depending on the size of the case and the issues involved, it's often, and I would say usually, possible to negotiate with opposing parties, or if necessary, get a court order that limits the discovery or phases the e-discovery to the key people first. And when you can do that, what we've often found is by the time you look at all the key people's electronically stored information, you've got more than you can handle, more than the other side wants, and then they're less enthusiastic about bringing in the auxiliary people who mostly have duplicative information. where we've been in situations where a case settles and it's never necessary to get to the sort of the secondary custodians. So I always recommend looking at least phasing the review of information. So you start with the key custodians and see if that gives you everything you need, and then you can expand from there if necessary, but at least try to limit it first.
And we did a podcast with Sherry Harris on sort of e-focusing right in on the key custodian. So it sounds like you're on the same page with her on the importance of that. The second item that you mentioned is maximizing the use of in-house resources. How does that save money?
Well, you know, and this varies from company to company and party to party in litigation, but we represent a lot of corporations. Many of the corporations have very sophisticated IT people in-house. Some of these corporations are subject to repetitive lawsuits or they're in litigation all the time. And the ones that use vendors to do every step of the process are paying more than the ones that have developed some in-house capability. I think it's important to understand what you can do and what you can't do effectively, and you don't, as a corporation, want to bite off more than you can handle in terms of processing things in-house. But if you have enough e-discovery, then it makes sense to create some dedicated positions in-house, or at least make it the part-time responsibility of some existing employees to manage some of the process. And depending on the sophistication of the IT folks, they can certainly often do collection or help in the collection rather than having a vendor come in and do all that work. They may be able to help with filtering if you're using vendors that charge based on the volume of information that you give them in the first place. Then it can make sense to do some filtering in-house. And we have some clients who do more, that have enough e-discovery that justifies doing more, and they invest in some of the e-discovery software. And so, you know, obviously it depends on the company, it depends on the cases, but you should do an analysis and figure out whether you can save money by moving some of the work in-house that you would otherwise be paying vendors or law firms to perform.
Okay, your next item is obtaining competitive bids from your vendors. Does that include law firms, Dave?
Well, I think it can include law firms. It can include e-discovery vendors. What we have found is that there can be huge cost differences in what you pay for very similar tasks, and different vendors and different law firms have different price structures. And so rather than going with the first one that you talk to, find out more about the price structure, how that impacts a particular project which you have, and then do some comparison shopping. And we've managed at times to reduce costs by 50% or more simply by shopping around and finding a lower cost vendor.
Sometimes you just use that to get the vendor you want to work with more in line, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many e-discovery vendors and consultants out there now. We have a database that has over 200 of them listed, and they are all hungry for work. Most of them have somewhat flexible pricing. We obviously, you know, quality has to be there, and we keep track of who's done a good job for us in the past, and they're going to get, you know, the benefit of the doubt if the money is close. But even if you think you know who you want, you can get better pricing if they know that you're paying attention to the pricing and if you're comparing their pricing to other vendors out there.
Okay. Your fourth tip is to engage in iterative searching and sampling, sort of the search and retrieval area that a lot of people are focusing on right now. What do you mean by this?
And I would say that this is probably the most overlooked and most undervalued tip out of all of them. So this is one of my favorites because I have found that in most projects we are able to narrow the volume of electronically stored information that needs to be reviewed anywhere from usually 25% to 75% simply by having narrow searches. What often happens is parties collect the electronically stored information, and then they're trying to find what's relevant or at least what needs to be reviewed for relevance. most common way to do that is to come up with a list of search terms and to start by looking at any documents that contain the search terms. And there's a number of things you can do to make those searches more effective. First of all, you don't want to use software which just looks for one term or another term or another term, because that's overbroad. Very often, usually, you can take some of those terms, and unless they're in proximity to each other, for example, within 10 words of each other or within 25 words of each other, then they're not finding relevant documents. They may be finding irrelevant documents. And, of course, this is, you know, depends on the case, depends on the issues. There may be some terms that by themselves, if they are located anywhere in the document, there's a significant possibility that that document's relevant to the matter. But there are some other terms that may be very common words where the only way they're going to indicate a relevant document is when more than one of those terms is in proximity to another one of those terms. And so you want to make sure that you're using software that allows you to do that kind of proximity searching. You're going to want to narrow by date ranges. You're going to want the flexibility to narrow by date ranges within a particular custodian because, you know, somebody might have transferred departments or have only been in a relevant position for a number of years. Anything you can do in the at the front end to narrow the searches and reduce the population of documents that needs to be reviewed is a big plus. But a big thing that a lot of people don't do is once they come up with a list of search terms, they run the search terms, and that's it. Everything that hits the search terms then gets reviewed, and that's the expensive part of the process, is having human beings review the documents. What we try to do is we run our first draft of the search terms after analyzing them carefully, and we look at the results. We print hit-by-term reports, and we see which of the terms that we ran have how many hits. And invariably, we're going to see situations where some of the terms are going to be responsible for hitting on a lot of the documents. And the question is that because those documents are relevant, or is that because those terms are hitting irrelevant documents? Sometimes you can just use common sense and figure out the answer to that. Sometimes you need to do some sampling. But we typically go through multiple iterations where we narrow the search terms. If a particular term is coming up with way more hits than we expect, then we look at those documents and see, is that term being used in the context where it's relevant, or is that being used in irrelevant contexts? And how can we narrow that search to just find the documents that have a reasonable chance of being relevant to the issues in dispute? And so we'll go through another set of searches, another iteration of search terms, and try again to narrow down the amount of information that needs to be reviewed so that you're maintaining everything that's potentially relevant to the litigation, but you're eliminating irrelevant information from the necessity for human review.
Okay. I love the answer. That's my field. So good answer. apply three kinds of deduping strategies. How does that save money, and what do you mean?
And of course, deduping is finding copies of the same document in multiple places. And what you want to avoid doing is paying lawyers to review the same document multiple times, just because you have multiple copies in the population of documents. Now, what we've found is it's very typical for vendors, virtually any vendor out there will do within custodian deduping for you. In other words, if I go to collect all of Carl Shinneman's emails and I find two copies of the same email, it will dedupe them out so that we only are left with one copy of that email. What is more tricky is deduping across custodians, so that if Carl Shinneman and David Cohen are both custodians and the two of us each have a copy of the same email, rather than paying to have that reviewed twice, what we'd like to do is have that reviewed once, which is across custodian deduping. But it's also important to maintain records as to who had custody of that, because sometimes it can be important in a case to know who had possession of a document. And so the ideal thing to do, and what we do with our software, is we dedupe across custodians, but we also maintain a log of who had copies of that email so that we can, when we produce the documents, either reinsert that document once it's been reviewed and confirmed to be responsive, reinsert that for each custodian, or if the other side prefers, and they typically do, they don't want multiple copies of it either, when we give them the documents, give them the log of who had custody of which documents in their document populations. That's the second kind of deduping, a cross-custodian deduping, and that can further reduce the population of documents to be reviewed. In some cases, it's not unusual for us to knock out 10% or 20% of the documents to be reviewed just by that cross-custodian deduping. There is a third kind of deduping, which is, we'll take the example of emails, lesser included email chains. And what I'm referring to here is if I send you an email and you send me an email back, a reply, then if your settings are like most people's, my original email will be underneath yours. So there'll be a chain there. And then I might send another one back to you, and before you know it, you have six copies of the original email in these various email chains. There's no reason to pay to have that reviewed six times. We use a 10x software which can be used to identify the longest inclusive email chain and review that, make decisions based on that, and those decisions then get applied to the lesser chains of email so that you're not reviewing the lesser chains. Again, that can greatly cut down the volume of documents that you need to pay human beings to review.
Okay, now let's talk about getting rid of the human beings. Explore alternatives to 100% human review. Back when I was in staffing, I never could have said this.
Well, and you know, the staffing companies don't always love this, and for that matter, you know, some of my partners in my law firm don't love some of what I recommend, because really what we're trying to do is cut costs, and the way to cut costs, again, is to reduce the human review as much as possible, because the automated processes tend to be much more cost efficient. What you do have to be careful about, though, is not getting rid of documents that may be relevant or responsive, and the computers have yet to be invented that have artificial intelligence that matches human intelligence. So you've got to be judicious about how you do this. But the fact remains that in many cases, the amounts at issue almost make it cost prohibitive to do full reviews of every document. And in certain situations, you have to come up with accommodations. One possibility that we've done in certain situations, and again, the client has to fully understand the risks, rather than doing a review before producing every document, do a production prior to review. I would never do this without a non-waiver order or non-waiver agreement from the other side, but preferably a non-waiver order so you get the protections of Federal Rule of Evidence 502 and other state rules as far as they go, and get an agreement from the other side that you can recall anything privileged, and then run terms that will at least identify 99% of what might be privileged. Run words like the names of known lawyers and words like lawyer and esquire and legal advice and privilege and so on and so forth. And so you've at least made a good faith effort to call out anything privileged, notwithstanding your non-waiver order or agreement, and then sample some of what's left to make sure you're not missing things. But then in an appropriate case, you may need to produce documents without humanly reviewing every one of them. In such circumstances, you could also come up with some subset of terms that is likely to identify the documents most likely to be critical in the case, so you at least look at those documents before you're producing them to the other side and know what you're producing, but you don't necessarily have a human review of every single document before you produce it. So that's one example of where you can have alternatives to 100% human review. Again, you've got to judge this on a case-by-case basis, and you've got to be aware of the risks of producing any document that you haven't had a lawyer look at before production. But in some cases, it can make sense to do that.
Okay. Reviewing in native mode. Explain how that's going to save money.
Well, very often in our experience, when you get electronically stored information processed, one of the first things that a vendor will tell you to do is get it all converted into TIFF format. But you're paying for that conversion. And even though it may be the case that the other side is going to want you to produce in TIFF format, or you may want to produce in TIFF format for one reason or another, that doesn't mean that you have to TIFF everything, because what about the documents that are non-responsive? Why should you pay the money to TIFF those documents? And I've seen, you know, all kinds of different pricing for how much it costs, but it can cost 5 cents a page. I've seen 10 cents, 12 cents a page just to TIFF the documents. If you have a very large population of documents, that's spending a lot of money on the TIFFing process. There is litigation support software out there, including several of the packages we use, like Atenix and Ringtail, that can handle documents in native mode as well as in TIFF mode. And by doing the review in native mode first, if you can do it as quickly or more quickly in native mode, then you eliminate the need to pay the cost of doing the TIFF conversion for those documents that don't end up being relevant or responsive.
Okay, and you talked a little bit about using some advanced review software. You've mentioned some of those packages, which I love hearing because those are the ones we use too.
Well, in fairness, there are other packages out there, and to be an equal opportunity employer, I'll mention a couple of those other ones in this answer. You know, in addition to some of the capabilities I've already talked about, such as the ability to do deduping, including lesser included email chains, and the ability to, you know, run hit-by-term reports and do various other things that help you narrow down the population, one of the things that software can do for you is help you organize the documents for a more efficient review. The way document review traditionally was performed was by people going through by custodian, essentially file by file, as the documents are kept in a particular person's file. And you're going to be running into a lot of different documents together in the file, and you're going to be documents that are related to each other may be separated by many other documents. And you may have different reviewers reviewing the same kinds of documents, and each has to get up the learning curve. To make a long story short, that kind of serial traditional review can take a long time. If your documents are organized by subject matter so that documents that are talking about the same thing are grouped together, in our experience, the review goes much, much faster. And there are a number of packages that can help you organize the documents by subject matter or in other efficient ways like that to make the review go faster. And I've already mentioned Atenix. I'm happy to plug it. We love it. But there's other packages out there that also do similar things. Stratify is one. Catafora is one. So you want to look at some of these software packages that can help you when you actually get to the point of doing the review. Clearwell has some nice features. It can make the review go much faster.
Okay. Having the right people review as opposed to the wrong people. Who are the right people and who are the wrong people?
Well, there's two aspects to this, and one aspect is quality and the other aspect is price. And I'm going to say that in many cases, the wrong people to do the review are the associates at the law firm who are the trial counsel. Now, if it's a small document population, then yes, you want your trial team to be familiar with the documents, and there can be an advantage. But if it's a big quantity of documents, then you're just wasting money very often in having large teams of associates at associate billing rates perform large-scale review. And you're wasting money, and you're also not giving the best people the job, because most associates at big firms like mine don't sign up with a firm because they want to do endless document review. Of course, all of us litigators realize that, you know, you get down to the key documents, you need to look at them, and you need to be familiar with the important documents in order to prepare your case. But before you've done that culling of the important documents from the unimportant, that's a task that you don't need top 10% of the top 10 law school graduates in the country performing. And in fact, they're going to be bored with that work, and they're not going to perform it as well as lawyers who are interested in doing that work and happy to have that kind of work. And so a couple of alternative models have been developed. One that I used at some stages of my career was using temporary employees, and we still sometimes mix in temporary employees to our review teams. You can hire temp lawyers at much lower than the cost of associates. Another model that we've moved to at our law firm and others have moved to gets you a little bit more experience and a little bit more consistency, and that is creating staff lawyer positions where these are lawyers who want to do document review. We've turned it into a career track where people can actually get promoted and move up based on proven quality. And these are people that, that want to be doing the review. They get experienced in doing the review. You know that they're employees of the firm, so you're assured high quality. And that you pay them a lot less than you pay associates, and likewise, their billing rates are way less than associates. So don't pay associate rates for work that can be done better and less expensively by attorneys at lower billing rates.
Okay.
I also don't want to rule out, in certain circumstances, some documents can be reviewed by paralegals as opposed to attorneys or other lower-cost personnel, and it really depends on the nature of the project. For, you know, making privilege determinations, I think it's important to have lawyers do that for complex, critical determinations, but other kinds of determinations, often paralegals are very good at, and or even clerks can do certain kinds of document reviews.
Okay. And now to round out a top 10, streamlining the review speed and processes.
Well, I've heard it said that there's three important factors in doing effective reviews and doing a lot of things effectively, and that includes the people, that includes the technology, and that also includes the systems. We've talked a little bit about the people. We've talked a little bit about the technology in terms of kinds of software that you can use. But there are also a lot of tricks to the trade in terms of how you organize and manage document review projects. And there's more and less efficient ways to organize them. You want to make sure that your reviewers are motivated to perform quality reviews, but also to perform reviews efficiently and quickly. So how you supervise reviews, how you do quality control, how you batch documents for review, each aspect of the process can make a difference in terms of making the review faster and more efficient. And so those who've been down the road before and have managed these projects have learned some of the secrets to how to do this right. I don't have to tell you this, Carl, because I know you've managed a number of these projects, and you'd probably agree with me that you can sometimes improve efficiency by a factor of double if you manage the project well versus if you're, you know, going into your first project and you've never done this before and don't know how to properly manage it.
I like your next one of utilizing dual monitors, and I would add to that, or big monitors, real big monitors.
Yep.
Let's talk about this.
Yeah, if you've ever been in a big document review operation using some of this advanced software, ordinarily the people doing the review are looking at multiple screens. And just to take an easy example, one screen may have a copy of the document they're reviewing, but then they need to code certain information about that document. Is that document responsive? What issues does it relate to, or what document request does it relate to? Is it a document that's privileged? Certain information like that needs to be entered in. And if using one monitor, particularly a small monitor, the reviewer is going to be toggling back and forth between the document that they're looking at and whatever coding form they're filling out, or the equivalent of filling out a coding form. What we found is that when we moved to dual monitors, we increased the speed of the review by between 10 to 20% just by getting rid of all of that toggling. So that's getting through reviews quicker, less time that people are paying for, and I think it even cuts down on the risk of mistakes where the person can have the document and the coding form and be looking at both at the same time.
Okay, this the next one, you can open up or do the intro for a future podcast we're going to do on privilege logs, but let's talk about negotiating privilege log alternatives.
And I think this is a great tip. It can really save a lot of money because preparing privilege reviews is one of the expensive parts of e-discovery, particularly in a case where you end up with a decent collection of privileged documents, in other words, a large number of privileged documents. And, you know, the general rules are that you have to give the other side a privilege log that includes information such as the dates, the tos, the froms, the relines, etc. There's a couple of things you can do to make this more efficient. One is a lot of that information can be generated in an automated way because with electronically stored information, you have the tos and the froms and the dates already there. The problem is that you then have to clean that up quite a bit because the email addresses, for example, may be non-standard. There may be email aliases. The re-messages may not always be very descriptive, etc. And so one easy thing you can do is negotiate with the other side that, hey, we're going to just agree that for present purposes, we're just going to produce whatever the automated version of the log is. And then if either side has additional questions, like who is in this email alias or that kind of thing, they can come back and ask. But you don't automatically have to do all of that work up front. But the other thing we've been doing lately with some success is entering into agreements with opposing parties, and it's particularly easy if they have the same problem you do and have to produce a lot of privileged documents, that rather than logging every document, give us a list of all the privileged documents, and we'll pick a sampling of those documents that we want to see the log entries for. So maybe we pick 20% or 10% of the documents, and we want privileged log entries for these documents. And once we see those privileged log entries, if we're satisfied that the privilege calls have been made appropriately, or in some cases maybe we'll challenge them and want to look at the documents, but if we have faith that those privilege calls are being made accurately, we don't need to look at 100% of the privilege logs. Maybe we only need to look at 10% or 20% or sometimes fewer percent. And we've had success negotiating those agreements not only in the context of litigation, but also in the context of government investigations and other situations where the other side really doesn't want to spend a ton of time poring over every entry in a privilege log.
All right, we're going to go back to Native here, and we talked about not TIFFing everything, but working in Native, but you have a tip here about considering Native production options.
Yeah, and this is not necessarily appropriate for every case. There are advantages to TIFFing documents, and TIFF, of course, stands for Tagged Image File Format, and you know either that format or PDF, Portable Document Format. Those formats have some advantages. Number one, they make it much harder to alter a document. And I'm not suggesting, you know, intentional alteration, but even accidentally altering a document. They also allow you with software to automatically number every page of every document in ways that aren't too tough to do. And so those are both advantages. But there's also some disadvantages. We talked before about the cost of converting everything to a TIFF format. That's probably the biggest disadvantage. And then there are certain kinds of documents that aren't necessarily as useful when they're in TIFF format, and the one that springs to mind is, for example, spreadsheets. If you see a TIFF image of a spreadsheet, it can be almost useless, especially if it's a big spreadsheet that doesn't all fit in one page and you have to put together a jigsaw puzzle of pages to be able to read the spreadsheet. And then it's only showing what shows on the spreadsheet. It's not showing the formulas behind it. It doesn't allow you to see what would happen, for example, if you changed a number, how that would affect the spreadsheet. Of course, you can't do that with original produced documents, but you might want to create a copy of a spreadsheet in certain circumstances. And so there can be advantages to native production, but the biggest advantage, again, can be cost. It can be less expensive. And there are ways around the problems that are created. Again, the problems are the advantages of TIFF for PDF is it's harder to alter the document. But a way around that is to do a hash coding of the documents you're producing, and that way you can easily determine if a document has been altered afterwards. And as long as you retain a pristine set of documents in unaltered format and have the hash values, you can make sure that nothing's being improperly altered. And instead of maybe numbering every page, you can number the documents because you can do that in your file naming convention. So these are ways of cutting down processing costs, and they can be appropriate in some cases, although I think it's still the rule rather than the exception that more often than not documents do get produced in TIFF format.
Okay. being smart about spreadsheets and databases. I think you talked a little bit about that in the native production area.
Yeah, going in to a case, most cases, my first advice is don't TIFF all the spreadsheets, because it's not going to be, first of all, it can be very expensive, because spreadsheets can result in many, many, many pages of production. And some of those pages, depending on how settings are and everything, you end up with a lot of blank pages or pages that don't have much on them. If it's, the jigsaw puzzle situation with spreadsheets, you're getting information which is essentially useless. Rather than automatically TIFFing all spreadsheets going in, consider the alternative of, producing spreadsheets in native mode, and that the same would be true of databases, or even a more limited production, because there may be a whole lot of spreadsheets that may be tangentially relevant one way or another, but if you gave the other side an index and said, here are the spreadsheets that we have, which ones do you really want? Which ones are really going to be helpful to you? Same thing with databases. Do you really need all these database fields? Which of these fields are relevant to you? And frankly, some databases are too large to produce in any useful format, especially if they're mainframe kinds of databases and so on. But if you can limit the database by narrowing down, which records does the other side really need, which fields do they want to see, then maybe you can produce it in a printed format that makes sense, in a report format, or maybe you give them the spreadsheet in, Microsoft Access format, or even turn it into an Excel spreadsheet to make it both more useful and readable for the other side, and easier and less costly for the producing party to produce the document. So I would say that those questions should always be asked with both spreadsheets and databases. What is the most sensible way to produce these? Usually it's not to TIFF them for production.
Okay, number 15 is an interesting one, sharing your work product with opposing counsel.
What this refers to is the fact that too often in litigation, both parties are engaging in duplicative work. For example, this goes back to the days of when paper production was bigger, we would produce documents to the other side, and the other side would have them imaged. We might be imaging the same documents and each side's paying to do that. The other side might OCR them. We're OCRing the same documents and paying to do so. The other side might get them coded, indexing the to, the from, the date, etc. That can be done automatically with most electronically stored information, but with paper documents that you don't have in native electronic form, the best way to index them is usually having human coders go through and code all the documents. And does it make any sense for each different party to be paying to do the same kind of essentially bibliographic coding? Now, I recognize that there's some things that reflect attorney opinions or impressions or strategies. If you're coming up with your list of issues and you want to put them into put the documents into your conception of issues, that's something you may not want to share with the other side, probably don't want to share with the other side. But you know that both sides are going to want to know, the dates of the documents and who they're to and who they're from, and that basic bibliographic coding, why not share those efforts? Same thing with some of the ESI processes. Rather than having each side hire their own vendor to do duplicative work, can there be shared work where we both get together and hire one vendor, and that vendor supplies both sides with the information that we're looking for? And that vendor could be an e-discovery vendor. In some cases, that could be a law firm if it's a law firm that's not representing one or the other party in the case.
Okay. We're going to be doing a podcast on records management in the not-so-distant future in May, but let's talk about optimizing record management in advance of discovery. This is the future goal of every in-house person, but go ahead.
It is, and for good reason. And, what I found as e-discovery started to explode, earlier in this decade, clients would be very upset that, we've got these millions of pages of documents and it's going to cost a fortune to have to produce all these to the other side and review them and TIFF them and all these other things we have to do. And, particularly in situations where companies were keeping everything. They have, every email. They never got rid of email. They had every backup tape dating back, you know, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years. And so there were massive amounts of information. And again, the cost of e-discovery is driven by the volume more than anything else. And what we found is that a lot of these records, there were no reason the company should be keeping them. They were obsolete for business purposes, and it was just really a failure to have a good document management system that gets rid of records that are no longer useful and that have become obsolete. If you still have these documents, then you have an obligation to search them. And, of course, we should rush to caution everyone that once litigation is pending or even reasonably anticipated, you have an absolute duty to preserve anything that may be relevant. At that point, you can't get rid of any documents. But if companies had just if they just exercise good document management hygiene over time, where they keep records as long as they need to keep them for business purposes, or if they do anticipate litigation, for litigation purposes, but then eliminate the records and get rid of them, you know, in the regular course of business when they're no longer needed for business or legal purposes, then there's a lot less going into the top of the funnel, and they're going to save a lot of costs up front. And usually those, you know, the multiple copies of backup tapes dating back 10 years, they're going to be duplicative information, they're going to be irrelevant information, but you can't say that there's no document anywhere on any of those tapes that might not be relevant. So you still might have to search all of it if you're unsuccessful in limiting discovery and you've still retained all that information.
This one's Morgan Stanley would have liked to have optimized their backup procedures in advance of discovery. So why don't you hit this softball?
Yeah, and, you know, backup procedures are sort of the special case of document management procedures. And, of course, the 2006 amendments to the federal rules provide some protection here in limiting discovery from sources that aren't reasonably accessible because of burden or cost. But yet, judges have the discretion, and particularly they'll exercise this discretion if that's the only place they can find documents. You will see people forced to produce documents from backup tapes. Now, for disaster recovery purposes, I've talked to literally dozens of companies about backup tapes and why they have backup tapes. And if they're using backup tapes for the intended purpose, disaster recovery, so that they can restore their systems in the event of a system crash or a catastrophic event like a fire or an explosion, they don't need backup tapes dating back years for that purpose. In fact, most IT people have told me that if they have the last 2 or 3 weeks of backup tapes, that's sufficient. You really only need the latest full backup tape and any incremental backup since then, and maybe you want to go one or two or three backups prior to that last full backup, just in case data is corrupted or you run into some problems or there's some kind of slow-moving computer virus. But I've yet to have an IT person tell me why they need to retain backup tapes more than a month old if they are just retaining them for disaster recovery purposes and not as a document archive. And if they're using it as a document archive, that's not what backup tapes are designed for. There's better ways to create archives of records. So it's an easy way to greatly cut down on the volume of information that you have up front and have to search for litigation. Once again, of course, the caution, if you've already got litigation pending or reasonably anticipated, and you've got stuff on backup tapes potentially relevant to that, at that point it's too late. You got to wait till that litigation is over before you can retire those backup tapes or recycle those backup tapes.
All right, I don't know if I'm going to give you credit for a full 20 based on number 18. You might only get 19 tips. Eliminate smoking guns before they're created. I mean, don't do bad things. Go ahead. Explain this one.
Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds like easy advice, but how many companies do this right? And what do I mean by doing this right? How many companies have actually implemented training programs to train all of their employees about the dangers of email? To me, you know, using email should be like driving a car. You shouldn't be given the keys until you pass some tests and make sure you understand the rules of the road and essentially are licensed to use emails. Because, you know, we all know that you shouldn't write dumb emails, and yet every week a new story comes out about some smoking gun in a major litigation because somebody wrote a stupid email or text message or instant message. And so what we advise big companies to do, and small companies as well, is do training programs for your employees that teach the dangers of email, explode the myths. People still think of email as just like an oral conversation, you know, great way to share private jokes or say sarcastic or cynical things. They aren't thinking about the fact that email is forever, hard to get rid of it, it's discoverable, and it can really, what one person says can be held against a whole company. And so we've helped a number of clients implement effective training programs. It doesn't take a whole lot of time, but it is something that companies need to do to get rid of the smoking gun emails before they're created.
Okay, number 19 is to retain discovery counsel. I think there's probably a corollary to this. You could have a special master as well, right? Just getting someone learned involved.
Well, there depends if you're talking about one case or multiple cases, and I think we're among those who pioneered this idea of having discovery counsel separate from your trial counsel. So most big companies use multiple firms depending on the subject matter involved in the litigation, maybe the geographic location of the litigation investigation, and so they'll have different firms handling different litigation matters. But e-discovery, there's a lot of overlap, and there's a big learning curve in e-discovery relating to how the company keeps records, how the company, what internal processes they've developed for legal holds and for collecting and producing information, et cetera. And so the idea here is to take advantage of that learning curve, and rather than paying 10 different law firms to learn about your document management and come up with different hold procedures and sometimes apply inconsistent rules to producing documents, and some law firms are more sophisticated than others about saving clients money in terms of how they review, collect, review, and produce documents or negotiate. Hire one firm that has a concentrated practice in this area to be your discovery counsel, and that can be for one case or that can be for all of your cases, and you really get the benefit of the learning curve if it's for multiple cases. Have that firm come in on the e-discovery issues in every litigation and put it to that firm to save you money. Cut your e-discovery budget by magnitudes by doing it efficiently, by taking advantage of the learning curve, and by implementing some of these other things that we're talking about here in terms of steps to reduce costs. And that I've seen this step reduce costs by more than 50%. In other words, companies have managed to cut their e-discovery budgets by over half by having special e-discovery counsel.
Okay, and we're on the last one, number 20. Employ motions for protective orders or cost shifting. I know you were involved in a case in this area that was very successful.
Yeah, in one case we actually got in the Delta Financial case in New York, the court ordered 100% of the costs of the further discovery that the other side was seeking. They had to reimburse us those costs, including the costs of the attorneys reviewing the documents for responsiveness and privilege. And that's the best case scenario. I certainly don't promise clients that in every case, but I think courts are getting more and more open to the idea that there needs to be balance, and there needs to be balance not only vis-a-vis the parties, but also balancing the burden of discovery against what is involved in the case. And where one side is clearly overreaching and going beyond what's reasonable in terms of requesting information, more and more courts are open to the idea of limiting discovery, of employing cost shifting, of employing creative approaches like sampling or phasing discovery. Now, in our experience, trial counsel is sometimes hesitant to seek these kinds of motions for cost shifting or protective orders, and sometimes that's because the trial counsel aren't you know, very well versed in e-discovery, don't have a lot of experience in that area, or they're just focused on the main substantive issues, or they're concerned about how a judge may react to this kind of motion. And of course, when we're discovery counsel in a case, you certainly have to discuss these issues with trial counsel and defer to their judgment to a large extent in terms of the relations and how the judge is going to consider these kinds of issues. But having said that, in many circumstances, it's perfectly appropriate to move for a protective order or to move for cost shifting. You don't do that, you know, the first thing, or if the other side's being completely reasonable and limiting what they request. But when the other side's overreaching, this can be another great tool for limiting discovery or recovering some of your costs that the discovery is imposing on you.
Great. Well, we got through it. Dave, thanks for joining us and sharing all these very useful tips. And hopefully we'll have you on another show soon.
Thank you, Carl.
Okay. Everyone, you've listened to another edition of ESI Bytes, and the goal is for you to visit esibytes.com to learn about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. For a full library of podcasts, you can visit www.esibytes.com. Thanks again, and have a nice day.